You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Political reporters conveniently carve up the country into red and blue states, describe soccer moms and NASCAR dads as important voting blocks, and argue that the middle of the country is drastically different from either of the coasts. But the United States is more complex than these generalizations would suggest, and journalist Dante Cini set out to prove just that. He teamed up with James Gimpel to look closely at data such as household income, education, housing, religion, and the number of bookstores in an area. And from this information, they've come up with 12 different community types, which they describe in their book, A Patchwork Nation, The Surprising Truth About the Real America. It's published by Gotham Books, and I'm very pleased that it brings Dante Cini to our show today. Hello.
Hello. Thank you for having me.
We divide the country into red and blue states on election nights, but why do you say it misrepresents the country the rest of the time?
I think on election nights, look, it's helpful, right? I mean, we really do have, it's brand A or brand B on election night, usually, really. So you've got to use it to keep score, but red and blue is very helpful for telling you who won and how people voted, but it doesn't tell you anything about why, right? So the assumption that somebody in a blue community votes Democratic for the same reason as somebody in a different blue community next door or 100 miles away is just, it's not true. It's not, and if you've been around the country, you know that's true.
Well, you also use the phrase real American. Politicians often use that. What does that mean in a country as diverse as ours?
Yeah, there is no real America.
That's kind of like the silent majority, isn't it?
That's absolutely right. I mean, there's no such thing as a real America. And that's something, you know, we all have to keep in mind. I mean, and it's not that the people in, you know, it's not that the people in rural Nebraska aren't real. I mean, their America is just as real as the people who live in the WNYC listening area. I mean, it's...
No, they're not.
Don't say that. It's just a different... But the reality is the people who live in rural Nebraska, their reality, the thing they see every day is shaped by a different set of circumstances than the people who live around here.
When did it occur to you that there must be a way to move past those generalizations and understand the country better?
Well, I've been a journalist for a while now, and I've done a lot of profiles of places. So I go to a place and kind of absorb it for a couple of days and write about what's happening there. And after you do that for a while, you start to realize that, you know, the crappy diner you're sitting in Tennessee really isn't that different from the crappy diner you sat in Ohio or in Minnesota. And the town, in fact, is somewhat similar. And, you know, if you do enough reporting like that, you drive around through these towns and you start to even get it like, well, I bet if I go to this corner, the donut shop will be up here and the cafe will be here.
Well, you've come up with 12 types of communities. I suspect that if you'd really wanted to cut it finer, you could have come up with 15, 20, 25.
Yeah, I think that's right. And I think there's 3,100 counties, and we broke them into 12 because when we did this, the idea was we wanted something between – this is a journalistic project. We want something between 10 and 15 types because we thought you get beyond 15 – it just becomes very hard to manage and make sense of. And when we broke down aiming between 10 and 15, we wound up with 12.
And you came up with an average U.S. county. Can you describe it?
Well, yeah, a lot of people would be surprised. The average U.S. county is probably much less wealthy than they'd imagine. I mean, the average U.S. county, and I don't have the book in front of me, actually, but it's about $38,000, I think, is the median household income. And that's much.
People can live on $38,000?
If you live in the right place, yeah. And but this gets to a very complicated question of the difference in where you live, right? I mean, what is middle class even, right? Of the U.S. median household income, if you did it across the whole country, is about $49,000, $50,000. But the counties are different because there are a lot of small counties with a lot of not very wealthy people. And when you see the world through the eyes of the people who live in these places, and some of these in the average county or these small town counties where people make $38,000, maybe the median household income is 30, maybe it's 28. You start to see everything very differently. And you start to see it differently, certainly from being inside the Beltway, which is a very skewed view of everything.
So would they have? Would there be a different average level of education in these counties?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, the way we broke these up, the big city, and it's actually interesting, the big city counties, the counties we call the industrial metropolis, of which New York is one, and I think all the five boroughs except Staten Island isn't. But the other four of the five boroughs are all this industrial metropolis category. You know, they have a lot of high education, a lot of wealth, but they also have high levels of poverty. But the places called the moneyed burbs have very high education levels. These places we call campus and careers, where there tends to be a university or college somewhere nearby, higher education levels. Other places, it's much lower, much lower.
Now, is this average community we've been talking about just as likely to be located in New England as in the Deep South?
That's an excellent question. The average community is really an average county, and where does it exist? It really exists in the mind, right? I mean, that's an excellent question to go through the stats and say if there's one county in America that would come the closest to what the average county would be. But that average would be an average between the poorest places and the richest places. And I think one of the points of Patchwork Nation is that, you know, it's all about context, right? So I think it's more like what's the average moneyed burb county like, because that's more like your experience if you live in that kind of
place. Well, let's talk about us for a moment.
Okay.
Industrial metropolis, it seems pretty straightforward. Mm-hmm. New York, Chicago, et cetera.
Yeah.
Are they the same? Or what about Buffalo, Detroit,
right.
Los Angeles,
well,
Seattle?
New York is actually, and I'm not just saying this because I'm on the radio in New York, but New York is truly different from every other place. It is denser than any other place. It has the differences, the extremes between extreme wealth and extreme poverty packed into a very dense place with a lot of different ethnicities, nationalities, religions. But the thing that really differentiates those industrial metropolis counties from other places is they're just amalgams of many different things. I mean, that's what really makes them stand out. Higher than average median household incomes, ultimately higher than average levels of educational attainment, but also high levels of poverty, right? High levels of people of non-English speakers. So they're a real mix of the top and the bottom. In fact, in some ways, if you really want to talk about, quote unquote, the real America, you could argue that the big cities, while they're not like the rest of America in terms of maybe use of reliance on cars and things like that, but in terms of being a good mix of what America is really like, in some ways they're actually not bad. They're not bad.
So Queens probably would be the closest to the real America because it has the widest range of nationalities.
Yeah, and a wide range of incomes. I mean, you know, that's the thing that's really interesting about there's all this talk in the last couple of days about taxes on millionaires and what middle class is, and your senator yesterday, Chuck Schumer, said that he doesn't want to tax people making over $250,000 a year because that's a lot of places that's middle class. Yeah, and, you know, not really. I mean, even in New York, Manhattan.
His friends make
That's right. I think people on the Upper West Side and Upper East Side maybe agree with that. But, you know, only 16% of the people who live in New York, make over $200,000 a year. The households, I mean.
My guest is Dante Cheney, who, with James Gimple, has written out Patchwork Nation, The Surprising Truth About the Real America, the 12 Community Types That Make Up Our Nation. It is published by Gotham Books. Well, let's talk about the kind of community that gets the most attention these days, the evangelical epicenter.
Yes.
Is this where the Tea Party comes from?
Somewhat. Though, you know, what is the Tea Party is a better question. I mean, I looked at this last year because I've been doing – this is not just a book. I mean, this is a regular reporting project I'm constantly doing and by, you know, the website's patchworknation.org. And I looked at Tea Party websites in different communities because I have these communities broken up. So what does a Tea Party website look like in an evangelical community? It actually looks quite different than a Tea Party website a lot of times in one of these places we call boomtowns. Where sometimes in boomtowns, the Tea Party is about, quote unquote, immigration, or it's about housing problems. And when you get to those evangelical communities, there's because I've done this, there's a much more religious tone to the Tea Party. I mean, the Tea Party at some point is going to split even more than it has, and it's going to fracture more than it has.
Well, because it's partly libertarian and partly social conservative.
Yes.
You chose Nixa, Missouri to illustrate what evangelical epicenters are like. What kind of town is it?
Nixa is, and I don't mean this in any bad way, it's not a pretty city. It's a small town that kind of sits outside of Springfield, so it's down in the southwest corner of the state near Branson. Branson's the big getaway area down there.
That's where all the country singers have their own theaters.
Yes, and it's the country music equivalent to Las Vegas, I guess. They are poorer than average, the evangelical epicenters, and that's true of Nixa as well. And the interesting thing about a place like Nixa and these evangelical epicenters in general is there's a lot of social conservatism, obviously, but they're not united the way you might imagine because of the nature of evangelical faiths. Is there are many, many churches in Nixa. There's a church in every block. And it's not like being in a Catholic community when the cardinal tells you what to do and that's what everybody does. This is a lot of different churches with a lot of different chiefs and a lot of different tribes.
A lot of different interpretations.
Absolutely. And their idea of community is very different. Nixa is a really interesting place where they don't have a library. The city of Nixa does not have a library because they just decided that we don't need a library. We'll use Springfield's library. And in part, I think that's because the allegiance there to a lot of the people in Nixa is to their church, the tithing to the church rather than to the community.
But you spoke to a man there who believed that the President Obama, would eliminate church services when he was elected. Did you find widespread distrust of the government and of President Obama in particular in these evangelical areas?
Yes. In a word, yes. I mean,
there are black evangelicals, too. Where were they on all of this?
That's true. The black evangelicals, remember, the Patrick Nation is broken up by geography. So the black evangelical communities tend to be, they often exist inside these industrial metropolis communities or in the South in these places we call Minority Central, which is kind of the old black South. But when you get to a place like Nixa and those evangelical epicenters, that's really kind of the white evangelical what there is of an establishment, that's where it is. And I think the best way to think of Nixa is, and the evangelical, that's Sarah Palin country, even more than Tea Party country. Like when Sarah Palin was put on the ticket in 2008, the people in Nixa were very, very excited. In fact, she was originally scheduled to speak there at Springfield in the basketball arena. It sold out so fast that they had to move, it sold out in a matter of minutes, and it's not sold out, the tickets were issued, and they had to move her out to the Bass Pro Shop fishing the parking lot because it was the only place big enough to get everybody. That's how they felt.
Are they as fiscally conservative as they are socially conservative?
They are, I would say, given the choice between those two things, they are much more about social conservatism than fiscal conservatism.
So they vote on issues like abortion, gay marriage. Is life difficult for someone who doesn't go along with the majority view in a town like Nixa?
I don't know if there are a lot of people.
They would move out.
Well, yeah, and there are some people who don't. And yeah, they will tell you that because I talk to Democrats and I'm in Nixa, and I talk to liberals and I'm in Nixa too. And the first thing they'll just do is shake their heads and just be like, well, it's part of living here. I mean, their jobs keep them there. But yes, it's not easy, I think.
What about other communities that make social issues a priority when voting? Are rural farm-based towns, the ones you call tractor country, similar to the evangelical epicenters?
Yeah, similar but dissimilar. Similar in that they're also culturally conservative. They have this other overlay that you just can't forget of the economics of agriculture weighing upon everything that happens in those places. In fact, tractor country, while the evangelical epicenters have been hit hard by the recession, there's been no recession in tractor country. The unemployment rate in those communities is only about 5%. There is no foreclosure crisis. They've really ridden everything out. Socially, they're very conservative. But the other thing is they're much more community-based in some ways than these evangelical epicenters are. Where the evangelical epicenters, everybody's giving to their different church, and that's really the definition of community. When you get to tractor country, these very small towns in the rural plains, it is really about the community. In fact, when the library burned down in Sioux Center, Iowa, which is where I go for this, the community came together to pay a ton of money for a beautiful Frank Lloyd Wright prairie-style library. It's gorgeous, and it's unbelievable. It's in a town of 6,000 people, but that's their idea of civic commitment. Civic pride is very different.
My guest is Dante Chinney, Chinni. He has written with James Gimple, Our Patchwork Nation, The Surprising Truth About the Real America, the 12 Community Types That Make Up Our Nation, and it has a foreword by Ray Suarez, who is a senior correspondent, in case you didn't know, with PBS NewsHour, used to be with NPR. The book is published by Gotham Books, and we will continue our conversation after we take a little break. We're back with Dante Chinney, who with James Gimple has written Our Patchwork Nation, The Surprising Truth About the Real America, the 12 Community Types That Make Up Our Nation, published by Gotham Books. I was surprised that one of your communities is the Mormon Outpost.
Mm.
I wouldn't have thought there were enough Mormons in this country other than people running for president to make up a whole community.
Well, yeah, a lot of people have asked me why the Mormons have their own community, and my answer is always, well, they were chosen. The Mormons have their own community, though, because we originally didn't have the Mormons. We originally had 11 community types, and we were doing this project, and we kept seeing the data, and we're like, you know, the Mormon places are different. They're really different. So I started going to this Mormon place out in Idaho, Burley. And,
but are we talking about Mormon places like the ones that we find in Utah or the ones where they're where polygamy is practiced.
We're talking about places where, whether polygamy is practiced there or not, I don't know. But these are places, the things that really differentiate those communities, obviously, from any of these other types, is strictly, extremely high levels of Mormon adherence to the Mormon faith. And they're really interesting because you think of the evangelical epicenters and talk about how people move in lockstep there. That's not really as true in the evangelical places because of these different churches. But in the Mormon communities, it really is true. It really is true that they have a lot of the cultural conservatism of the evangelical communities, but then the Mormon communities layer on top of that the structure of the church. A lot of these counties that I go to, these Mormon outpost counties, look, they were actually formed as Mormon communities. It was literally the church saying, you know, Goodman Lopate, go create a colony up in this place. And that became the basis of the county. Burley, Idaho, which is in Cassia County, every county commissioner is a Mormon. Every member of the Burley City Council is a Mormon, except for the mayor, but it's a weak mayor system.
So what does that mean for the politics of the town?
Extremely conservative. And it also means that the politics of the town happen in a very different kind of way, right? The reason why you kind of have to be a Mormon to be in the city council is a lot of what happens in a place like a Mormon outpost that's a real Mormon outpost happens away from the city hall chambers and in church, after services, after ceremonies, talking about things. And that's how a lot gets done in a place like that.
But would there be a Mormon community in a major city like New York or Chicago?
There definitely could be a Mormon community.
I mean, there are Mormons in
absolutely.
All of these cities.
Right, within. But, I mean, what really separates the things and what we're trying to talk about in Patchwork Nation is the place. So you have pockets of Mormons in New York, in Detroit, in Cleveland.
We have evangelical churches.
Yeah, absolutely. But their power, their influence on that community, they're just one voice of many voices in an extremely complex community.
You break down the suburbs into different categories. Do you think that the term suburban is too general?
Yes. What we do really is we have these suburban areas, and then we basically have these areas called the boom towns, which are kind of – they were at one time fast-growing suburban areas. And, you know, those places are different in a lot of ways. You know, an old money suburb really has a foundation. It has people who have been there for a long time. The families go back there sometimes for quite a long time. And the boom towns, they come in. And the community kind of springs up out of nowhere.
But you chose Los Alamos, New Mexico to represent what you call the moneyed burbs instead of places like New Canaan, Connecticut, Grosse Pointe, Michigan, or Silver Springs, Maryland.
The reason is the numbers work very well for a place like Los Alamos, and they do. And actually, Los Alamos really is a moneyed burb when you get right down to it. But it's so scientific, and and I say this in the nicest way, but this is just hyper-educated, pointy-headed scientist community, which is wonderful, but it's not truly my new moneyed burb community I'm going to is actually Nashua, up in New Hampshire, in some ways a much better fit.
Where do they tend to fall politically?
The burbs are very interesting. Barack Obama won the presidency because of the moneyed burbs. You could definitely argue. He won those places by 12 percentage points, 11 to 12 percentage points. And 4 million votes. They tend to be moderate, and their votes are generally up for grabs. And the thing that sways them is the economy. They were very angry in 2008, and I think they're probably going to be very angry again in 2012.
They've been hit hard by the recession?
Not as hard as other places in terms of unemployment, but they get hit hard in different ways. These are places, because we know this, we have statistics on this, people in the money burbs are the most heavily invested in the stock market on average. So they're watching the roller coaster ride, and they're feeling that personally. The other thing is, you know, the foreclosures are starting to rise there now in the money burbs. We've been looking at that. That's troubling, you know. And the unemployment rate may be below the national average, but what's expected in the money burbs is a very low unemployment rate. It's supposed to be a better life to begin with, right?
With immigration reform a growing national issue, what's happening in places that you call immigration nation?
They're going to be very tense, and Barack Obama won those places too in 2008.
Hispanics are moving out of Alabama, we are reading in the newspapers. Won't that hurt those communities? Because the local grocery stores and laundromats and the gas stations rely on those people as customers, don't they?
Well, and they never employ them because that would be wrong, right? But they do, and yeah, it will. And they're not just moving out of Alabama. El Mirage, Arizona, which is where I go for to look at Immigration Nation, they're moving out of there. They're moving out of there because because of the Arizona immigration law, but also because the economic opportunity isn't there right now. And those places are going to change a lot in the next couple of years.
Are they divided communities generally where stricter enforcement of immigration laws are creating problems?
Extremely. El Mirage, that's Maricopa County. Joe Arpaio is the sheriff down there. I don't know if people know.
The famous Joe, yes.
The famous Joe. And they actually had an informal phone tree set up where if there was a sheriff's cruiser on a corner in El Mirage, they would call each other and say, stay away from corner X. There's a car there now.
But how does he continue to be elected sheriff if the majority are immigrants?
They're not the majority, but they're a large percentage. And the other thing to keep in mind—
So this means it's a totally polarized community.
Incredibly. Yeah, incredibly polarized. I've never been to a place like El Mirage. That was one of the most interesting experiences I've had as a journalist in the United States.
Were you surprised by anything when you were looking closely at the country and compiling all of this data?
I think the thing that surprised me most looking at all the data was, first of all, the lack of how low incomes are generally. And we forget that, especially if you live in New York or Washington. But the thing that really did surprise me is it's the subtle things. So it's, you know, you go to these we looked at listenership to NPR. And it was interesting that in these military bastions, these places based around military bases, they listen. They're very conservative, but they listen to more NPR than a lot of other places that are very conservative. And why is that? Well, the reason is their view of the world is about looking out what's happening in foreign affairs and the military. And you just can't get that unless you've got a radio presence in some of these places that's doing reporting. I mean, they might like to listen to Rush Limbaugh for point of view. But when it comes to trying to figure out what the heck is going on where they're – friends, you know, neighbors, husbands, wives are fighting. They listen to other stuff, and it changes their worldview.
It also means that they trust NPR to be giving them a fair view of what's going on in the world.
I think so. I also think that it's that or nothing. I mean, they really, it's, you know, when you look at radio
news. What
are the
newspapers like in these communities?
It was really interesting. The community I go to for my military bastion is Hopkinsville, Kentucky, which is where Fort Campbell is. The anniversary of the Iraq War, and I think at the time it might have been the 5-year anniversary of the Iraq War, might have been the 6-year anniversary of the Iraq War, there wasn't a single story in the local paper about the 5-year anniversary of the war. And I was just...
In a military area.
And this is a town that they basically lost 30,000 people going to fight. They just left town. And they didn't write about it at all. Interesting.
Dante Cheney is my guest. He and James Kimple have written Our Patchwork Nation for Gotham Books. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. How do you think that the information that you have presented here should be used?
Well, I think the most important message in the book is we all live in a bubble, right? Everybody lives in a bubble. And I hope the book, what it does in hell, is it helps to prick the bubbles and help you understand. It's easy to just say, what's the matter with Kansas, right? I live in New York. What's the matter with Kansas?
But don't forget that in New York we're now seeing protests where people are saying we're the 99%.
Right, right. And I think that's really fascinating. But the thing to keep in mind is while you're thinking, what's the matter with Kansas, Kansas is looking at you and thinking, what the hell's the matter with New York? Why are they the way they are? And that's important to keep in mind. It's about the world around you and the community around you shapes the way you see the world. And
but Kansas, the reason that that question was asked by Thomas Frank was that Kansas used to be a very liberal state,
right,
with a progressive party, and now it's very conservative. Right. So it changed.
Oh, it did.
New York has remained a lot more consistent, hasn't it?
Yeah, I think that's true. But I think what's happened is religion and cultural, as religion has become, and particularly evangelical faiths have become more closely aligned with the Republican Party. The way they look at this, the other part of Frank's argument, and I like what's the matter with Kansas, is, you know, why don't these people vote their economic interest? And their response is, well, it's not about my economic interest. Why are you condemning yourself, you know, to hell? That's why some of them would look at it and say, like, they've got the long view. The long view is someday they're going to die and they want to go to heaven. It's not about just their economic interest. It's just a different way of looking at it.
Let's talk a bit about the boomtowns. You mentioned them. Mm-hmm. You write about Eagle, Colorado.
Yeah.
What spurred the growth of places like that?
Housing. Eagle is actually a really good boom town. It's a place where the population doubled in the space of about 5 years, and it's because a huge plot of land was sold, and then housing came in there. And this was when everything was going well. The housing boom was self-perpetuating. So people would come in, they'd buy a house, and then a housing industry sprung up around it where, you know, I was doing HVAC and you were doing carpentry and we were all building houses together, and all of a sudden we have a lot of money in our bank accounts. So what do? Well, we buy some of the expensive houses that we're building, right?
And then the whole thing collapses.
Right, and then the music stops and people are trapped there in houses that are worth 40% of their value with no way out.
So what happens in an area where people on average owe more than people in other areas?
I don't know. I mean, I really don't know with a place like Eagle. When I talk to the people out there now, they're convinced that it's done. Something has fundamentally changed, and it'll never be what it appeared it was going to be for a little while. And I don't know what happens to the boom towns. I really don't. Of all the communities in here, the boom towns are the one where I look at the cycle they're trapped in, and I simply I don't see a way out. I don't see a way out for them.
Well, they can sell if they can sell their homes, or then they have to move back to cities, don't they?
They do, but then what happens to the real estate? What happens to the big houses that were built and now have to be sold for $200,000 instead of $400,000, $500,000? And you know, the interesting thing in a place like Eagle is they built this little downtown area, second little downtown area for all the housing developed. And when I first came, there was a very expensive Italian restaurant and this super expensive, a very nice steak place and a Starbucks. The Starbucks is gone. The Italian place is now like all-you-can-eat pasta for $9.99. And the steakhouse is still there because it's Colorado and the steaks are good. But it's so much cheaper. It's the entire economy the place was built around is just gone. And you're right, those people will have to move back to places their jobs if they can get out of their houses. But even that's going to take time. A lot of people there are just struggling trying to get by right now.
How would you describe what you call service worker centers? Are places like that more susceptible to economic downturns because they rely heavily on tourism?
I think they are the canaries in the coal mine when you look at the U.S. economy, because they really do. The way I put it in the book is they rely on the kindness of others, right? People have to come and spend money in the service worker centers, or those are really just small towns where we're all running a little shop and trading money, and we need cash infusion from someplace else to help the place grow.
So their economies are tied closely to the economies of the industrial metropolises because those are the people who come.
Absolutely. And if those people stop coming, or if they come less, or if a 3-day trip becomes a 2-day trip, different world.
You compare the number of gun shops to the number of bookstores.
Yeah.
What did you find?
Well, you know, the number of gun stores and bookshops is not a true test of, you know, look, people have guns in some places because, look, if you live in Sioux Center, Iowa, and there's a lot of hunting around you, you're going to have a gun.
But even in towns like I've spent a fair amount of time in a town called Yucca Valley in California, mm-hmm. and it's actually the big town in the area in the high desert, and a lot of gun shops.
Right.
I don't remember seeing any bookshops at all.
There's
a Pay for Less. There's a Stater Brothers. There's a lot of supermarkets.
Well,
there's a Walmart outside of town.
That's probably common.
Where you get your books.
Right. That's right. Well, and increasingly, you know, it's going to be interesting to recrunch that bookstore number in about 2 or 3 years. I mean, even since we did this book, there are no borders anymore. That's a lot of bookstores subtracted from the equation.
But I would think that gun shops also tell you something about a town's attitude about things. I mean, whether people use guns or not, the NRA has a lot of symbolic value for many people.
Yeah, I think it does. But I do think that when we looked at where the stores are per thousand population, you know, they're in places where people are primarily using them for, you know, hunting.
So, but if I were to go to a community where I saw a lot of gun shops and no bookstores, would that in any way reveal how that town might vote?
Yeah, I think it would. I think it definitely would, yeah. Absolutely. I mean, all these things, you know, it's really weird. Like commercialism and the stores, because we look at where Starbucks are located, things like this, those things are very revealing. They tell you something about a place.
This morning I heard a report on the current situation in the Republican Party, and one of the consultants said, you know what? It comes back to that old thing. It's all about the economy, stupid. Is that true? I get the feeling from what you're saying here that's only partly true.
The way to look at it is this. I can probably tell you right now with these 12 types they've identified, these 12 county types they've identified, I can tell you which way most of them are going to vote in 2012. But it's a question of margins. It's a question of margins. And I do think in some places, like the evangelical epicenters, it doesn't matter how good or bad the economy is. They're going to vote the way they're going to vote. But I do think that in the moneyed burbs, it matters. And ultimately, that's what we're talking about. We're talking about swinging 4 to 5 percentage points one way or the other.
My listeners are interested in where the immigrants are going when they get pushed out of these places in Alabama, Arizona. And earlier, I think I heard about a community in Maryland that did it and actually suffered economically as a result.
And they're gonna suffer, and the businesses are going to suffer. And that's something people are going to have to get used to. But I think where they're going, we're going to have to wait for the next census to see where they've moved. But increasingly, they've moved into the upper Midwest. We've seen a lot of the immigrants move. But a lot of them, when I talk to the people down in El Mirage, a lot of those folks down there, the illegals, have actually gone back to Mexico because the opportunities aren't here.
Antonio in Park Slope asks the question that many magazines ask. What city or town is the most logical in its design and accessibility? What kind of people would live there? I mean, there are always these articles on the most livable city in America.
Right.
And I always wonder what the heck that means. I couldn't get a job in that city.
Right. Well, and what's the criteria for livable? I mean, you know, look, if you're dealing in agriculture, livable is having a lot of places to park your pickup truck. You know, it's a little different than it is in living in New York City. But, you know, obviously, I think in terms of the use of resources, the industrial metropolis has a lot going for it because it's dense. You waste less fossil fuels in a place like that. But, you know, that doesn't really work for an agricultural community. You can't have something like that.
Dante Cheney is a correspondent for the Patchwork Nation Project, a collaboration among the Christian Science Monitor, PBS NewsHour, and PBS member stations. It's funded by the Knight Foundation. He has written a book with James Gimple, who's a professor of government at the University of Maryland in College Park, called Our Patchwork Nation, The Surprising Truth About the Real America, the 12 Community Types That Make Up Our Nation. It's published by Gotham Books. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.